Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for December 7th, 2020. This is Air Force veteran David Corey along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thank you for joining us this evening. We hope you all are doing well. I know it's been a stressful and difficult year for everyone, the whole country, and in fact the whole world. And as 2020 nears its end and New Year begins, let's hope the next year is better than this one's been. Meanwhile, we've got a great show for you tonight. And to get things rolling, let's first go over to Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard. How things going?
Hey there, David. Everything's going pretty well. And yeah, let's hope next year is a better year than this one. We've all been keeping busy as usual. We're helping as many veterans as we can, fighting the good fight against the VA for fair disability benefits. And tonight I'm pleased to say that we have a special guest, Lauren Price, who's also a wonderful advocate for our veterans. She's with the National Veterans Advocacy Group called the Veteran Warriors. And tonight she's going to discuss some important issues of great interest to our veterans and their families. First, though, once again, I want to remind everyone that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views and comments and questions. So at any time during the show you want to give us a call, that number is 1-888-627-6008, and we do welcome your calls. And all you got to do is pick up the phone and dial 1-888-627-6008. And during the show, we'll give you that number again if you didn't have a chance to write it down. Now back over to you, David, and our guest, Lauren Price.
Thanks, Richard. And let me introduce our special guest. Lauren Price is the founder of Veteran Warriors, a national veterans advocacy group, and she has led that organization since its creation in 2009. She has testified before Congress on veteran issues. She served in the United States Navy for a decade between January 2005 and January 2015, including serving for more than a year in Iraq as a convoy driver as well as a public affairs officer in Baghdad. She co-founded the veterans group called Veterans Warriors with her husband, Jim Price, who is a retired Navy senior chief. And she's been our guest many times over the past several years to discuss topics such as toxic contamination of veterans caused by open-air burn pits, as well as the VA's Caregiver Support Program. Lauren is our guest again tonight to discuss the Caregiver Support Program and a recently filed lawsuit against the VA. So let's welcome Lauren Price to the Veterans News Hour. How are you, Lauren?
I'm just fine. Thank you, Rick, and thank you, David. I really appreciate you having me on again.
Well, we're certainly glad you can join us. Now, I know the VA is in the process of changing this family caregiver assistance or support program. Before getting into the details, can you first explain really what the big picture purpose of that program is?
Well, it goes back to the, bear with me, like most people, health isn't great anymore. The purpose behind the original law was that we have a lot of veterans that are coming home with more catastrophic injuries, more serious injuries, but because of modern medicine, they don't necessarily need to be in a nursing home or an assisted living facility. And it's much cheaper and far better for the veterans' emotional well-being as well as long-term health for them to be at home in their own residence with their family, whether it's their spouse or their parents or what have you. And numerous studies over decades have shown that that positive outlook helps with healing, helps recovery, and helps keep people stabilized, especially those who've had very serious injuries or life-changing injuries. So the law got made in 2010 to create the program so that the caregiver, whether it be a spouse or a parent or even another relative, could stay with the veteran, and they provided a, it's not a compensation, it is a stipend, it's called, to help offset some of the losses that the caregiver might suffer for staying home with the veteran. They also, in specific cases, provide health insurance for the caregiver if no other health insurance is available to that person. And they base it on three tiers of need, tier one being the lowest, which was equated to about 10 hours a week of assistance. Tier two is 20 hours a week, and tier three was 40 or more. And the stipends were adjusted accordingly. In 2018, the Mission Act was enacted, and it was a massive bill that covers an enormous amount of different sectors of the VA and its purposes and its mission. Three small sections of that law made drastic changes to the eligibility, who could get into this program. And specifically, when I say drastic changes, it was for the first 8 years, only post 9/11 serving veterans were eligible for this program. And I'm sure everyone out there, and yourselves included, know the angst that was felt throughout the veteran community when this one group of veterans was segregated to receive a benefit that nobody else could have. And so come 2018, unfortunately, we weren't permitted to weigh in on the negotiating part of the bill, but they decided to open it to all eras on a tiered schedule. The first one, and it was it's counterintuitive the way it's laid out, the first group that would be allowed to come in would be the Vietnam era, and then it would go to the rest of them, meaning Korea, World War II, if there are going to be any left, 2 years after the Vietnam era were let in. One of the other small clauses of the three was that the VA had to set up a new software program to run this program, one that would copy to the medical records of the veteran. And that doesn't sound like a big deal. And last, a year and a half ago, we met with the Secretary's office, and we were told that they were going to, they tried to build it themselves, and they failed, and that they had decided to buy it, quote, off the shelf. In other words, buy it from a civilian provider and just plug and play, get the software in and get it rolling. Fast forward to October of 2020, they finally certified was the term, certified that this new software was viable. They actually went live with the software a year ago, and it took them another year to certify the software, which was the benchmark to allow Vietnam-era veterans to start applying for the program. Since then, they're receiving applications from these veterans. There has been no big overt push by VA to notify them, notify that entire era. There's been no outreach by VA to educate them or their caregivers on what the program is about, its eligibility criteria. And, of course, we still have the rest of those veterans who are still not eligible for this program, who are beyond livid at this point, that the way this new part of the law was structured, that they're still left out. Since then, they were also required to, and this goes hand in hand with any federal law, the agency involved is allowed to create rules. Well, VA already had rules in place for this program that they refused to follow. With Mission Act getting enacted, VA took it upon themselves to set up a whole new set of rules for the program, and they enacted those on October 1 of this year.
Lauren, if I could just ask you, before getting into those new regulations, I know your group is truly a national expert in advocating for veterans and their families, but also to monitoring and doing research about the implementation of the program even before the Mission Act. And I know your organization and you personally know a lot about the problems that were in existence. Could you give that background for our listeners about some of the problems and people being kicked off the program, et cetera?
Well, and as I referenced those first set of rules that they didn't follow, the VA had what was called the final rule, that went into place January 9th of 2015. That rule and the interim rules prior to that, no one in the VA was trained on them. And we had that directly also from the Secretary's office, that they had never trained and had no plans to train their employees, the 600-plus employees that work in this program, on the law, on what it says regarding eligibility, maintaining eligibility in the program, what they're allowed to do, the VA, not to do, all these things. They refused to train them. And in late 2013, we discovered that they were revoking, which is kicking people out of the program, revoking huge numbers. They started in late 2013 with a couple of hundred in one location. By the end of 2017, there were over 40,000 families revoked from the program.
Wow.
And we have had not one but two separate roundtables with members of Congress and VA over this. We've had a congressional hearing over it. We filed, we had a meeting with the executive offices, which is part of the White House, over this. And at no point does VA ever come out and admit that they're actually culling the herd. And when they're telling people, and I'm talking in the numbers in the hundreds, that you've graduated, you've recovered, or even if you have not recovered, well, that's too bad. You've been in the program too long. They spent years telling everybody, and I mean everyone that they came in contact with, that this was a rehabilitation-based program and that the sole goal was to move the veteran through the program and to graduate them.
But was there anything in the law that said that?
Absolutely nothing. Nothing in the law, even in their own rules. In the interim rule, the final rule, there's nothing anywhere. And we've pointed this out. We've taken this to the Office of Inspector General, even the Office of General Counsel over this. That nowhere did they have this legal authority to, A, use this language, to, B, make these determinations, and most importantly, to remove people from the program based solely, not on clinical eligibility, but on their numbers, on how long they were in the program or what have you. And then we started getting insider information. We have several whistleblowers that work in the program that communicate with us through secure channels that give us information. And VA found out pretty quick that we were finding out just how bad it was. She still works for the program. There's a woman that went to Hampton VA on a Thursday, and she had brought with her a team to sit down and spend the weekend writing up revocations for the highest level for Tier 3 people, and without even looking at their charts, without having meetings with their doctors, all of these things. And eligibility was written out in the original rules that it was to be determined by the veteran's primary care doctor or their primary care team. That most of these primary, and I'm talking across the country, thousands and thousands of veterans, their primary care providers had no idea. They were banned from discussing the program. They weren't allowed to talk to anybody in the program. They weren't allowed to communicate in the program. And if they attempted to, their records would go missing. The records from the primary care doctors would go missing. Records were being altered. We've proven that the old software they used, which was one of the key pieces of that legislation that went through, was getting rid of it because they were using it to communicate because it copied nowhere. No one had access to it other than those who work in this program. So they were using it as an internal method of communication to discuss how to revoke people. They were discussing numbers on how many people they were going to revoke, how many tier threes this month. And to the woman that came down from the VA central office to Hampton, she told them that they were over 500 on their tier three, and they were going to get that down over 100 by Monday from a Thursday. So they were just going to sit there, and we call it in the military, pencil whip them, just document these records and kick people out. That happened consistently until under former Secretary Shulkin, we got the very first moratorium put in, and it was a saving grace, but it didn't fix anything. They did nothing. They issued a directive that went to the very soul of, we're going to take away even more rights that you have. You don't have very many under this program. but we're going to take away even more of them. And now we're going to disallow you from having a legitimate appeal process and things like this.
I see. Now, let me just ask this, Lauren, if I could. Now, just for the benefit of our listeners, this program, and correct me if I'm mistaken, is basically administered on the VA healthcare administration side of the VA as opposed to the benefits, so that when you just alluded to really a lack of an appeal avenue for people that were kicked off the program, could you explain really what that meant and what it didn't mean for a family that might be kicked off the program, what they were then faced with if they were trying to challenge this decision?
Well, and that was one of the key things we discovered very early on. The VA had a lot of input into writing the original law, and they made sure that it went in under the VHA side, the healthcare side, because it's administered, it was intended to be administered by the primary care team, and basically having an ambulatory care nurse in the program that would do the health checks at home and social workers as needed. That's an important thing to note. What happened was, when VA helped Congress draft this, they put it in, they actually wrote it right into the original law that, number one, that you get an appeal to the people who kicked you out, which, that's so counterintuitive to everything in the legal world. You get to ask the people that kicked you out to, hey, can you reconsider being a jerk? So then when they say no, and they will 100% of the time, when they say no, you get to ask their bosses. And I mean that literally. The people that are their supervisors are the next level up for your appeal. And they say no. And when you show that they've fabricated records, they have literally altered and fabricated federal records, they have perjured themselves in federal records, and you can prove all this and you show all this to everybody, you're done. You have no more appeal process. Doesn't matter. You can show criminal activity, and we've caught them. We have this. And it doesn't change anything, because the way they wrote in the law, that is the end of your appeal. Because under the VBA side, the Veterans Benefit Administration, there is a legal process for it's called due process. Sorry, folks, the Constitution does still matter. And if you don't agree with their decisions, you get to continue to appeal up to court, to go to court. In this stuff, you don't. You absolutely don't. They have their little fiefdoms, and once you become antagonistic to them and you disagree with them, that's it. All bets are off. You're not getting any further. And it doesn't matter if you can show that they've committed criminal activity in falsifying records. Because when you go to the VA central office and you stand there at 810 Vermont Avenue and you ask the people who are absolutely running this program, and I'm talking the national director and her boss, and you sit there and you show this stuff to them, and they look at you, and then they talk to you like you're a slow child that rides the short bus and say, well, what would you like us to do? And for the benefit of your readers or your listeners, I will say I don't repeat everything I said to them that day, the last time I was there, because what I want you to do is your job. I want you to abide by the law. And my organization has proven over and over and over again with hard evidence that they have committed perjury, that they've altered federal records, that they have removed federal records in an effort to cover their tracks, which is also a crime. And I cannot get the secretary to meet with us. We had a meeting scheduled to meet with Dr. Stone, who is the executive in charge of the healthcare side, and we were shanghaied. We were literally shanghaied. We were not allowed to meet with him. We went there thinking we were told we were going to have a meeting with him. And when we got onto the floor where we were supposed to go meet with him, we got taken by an assistant to the secretary into a vacant boardroom and basically sat there for 2 hours being berated and insulted about our work and right down to my military service, and it was horrific. But what it comes down to is it told us that all the way to the very top, it's not going to matter. That side of the house is not going to let us fix this unless we do something drastic.
So I understand now there's been a lawsuit filed. What's that about?
Well, I'll fast forward. These new rules that went into effect October 1, pardon me, a year ago, we found out that VA was, they filed a document on the Federal Register saying, hey, we're thinking about doing something. They don't elaborate. They just kind of, it's a one-page document called a REN. They filed it. We got notice of it. And that's when we asked for the meeting with the executive offices of the White House over it. And we knew what they were up to because of our insiders had already shared with us what exactly they were planning. We went and met with these executive office staff, and we were hopeful when we left there that we had opened the eyes of the White House to how bad this was. It didn't work. It was pointless. So we left there, and in March, almost immediately after the national COVID lockdown happened, including especially Washington, the VA issued its proposed rules. The document was 310 pages long, and the woman that actually sat in the meeting for VA with us, that executive office meeting, is the author of the document. The first 280 pages of it are gibberish. They're just gibberish. They're not actually the proposed rules. It was just garbage. It was only the last, like, 30 pages or something of it that was worthwhile and that actually was constructive, that discussed what they plan to do. We were the first ones to find it, and we set about discussing every single thing that they brought up and showing that VA did not have the legal authority to make some of the changes that they were proposing. And then we reached out to our partners in the community, and when I say that, it's law firms and it's members of Congress and the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, and just about anybody that touches the veteran community across the country. We handed this off to them and said, hey, we built a one-pager and sent it out. This is what's happening. Here's a copy of their proposed rules. You know, have at it. There were over 200 of us that filed oppositional comments, including the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. Our office worked with two attorney firms, National Veterans Legal Service Program and Sidley Austin, to construct our comments. And we based those comments in law. There's no opinion. There's no feelings involved. This is not an emotional issue. This is a matter of law.
Right.
And all these comments went in, and there was not a single positive comment that was consistently standalone positive. There were some that said, hey, they got this one thing right over here, but the other 900 of them are bad. So not one standalone good comment. Then July 31st, they issued the final rules. It was, again, 310 pages, and it was virtually identical to everything that they issued in March. In other words, nothing that was said by anyone, never mind my little lonely organization, never mind all the big six guys, all the big VSOs, all the big law firms in the country, the Senate, they didn't listen to anybody. They said, we don't care what any of you say, this is what we're going to do.
Wow.
And because of the way things work, because of literally the way things were happening with COVID, and all of the timing was very, very important to understand. They dropped the REN after Congress had gone on holiday break for Christmas. They dropped the proposed rules after Congress had shut down for COVID. The final rules they dropped after Congress recessed for the summer. When they did that, that barred us from utilizing the Congressional Review Act to stop them. We could not actually use that law to stop these or suspend these from going into effect in October. So we reached out to literally everybody that's involved. The House Committee on Veterans Affairs, the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, begging them for intervention, asking them to hold a hearing, even a virtual hearing on this. Because the stuff that they wanted to do violates the law. They do not have the authority to do this. VA does not have the legal authority to determine if a veteran has to have, they've changed it from the original law. VA has now decided that you have to have a 70% rating to be eligible at all for the program. That language never exists in either law. It doesn't exist. They've now restricted it down to the small sector of the population that has a 70% rating on something. And there are even more strict requirements that they added in that even those 70% are probably not going to be eligible. So after it went into effect, the first thing they did, they were required to do assessments of the existing, they called legacy participants, people that were already in the program.
Right.
They were supposed to assess them, and then they were supposed to change the stipend under this new rule thing that they created, which is going to financially devastate many people in the program. They completely altered against the law. Mind you, the law is clear on how the stipend is to be calculated. They changed it completely arbitrarily and removed one of the tiers, but they were supposed to do all of that after they did the assessment, and they didn't. People across the country, our phones and email and internet were exploding for 2 weeks straight because VA didn't tell anybody that they just changed the stipend calculation, and they just did it starting October 1. So people were getting weird numbers, weird dollar amounts, and the ones that didn't get a change were, they're paranoid, they're scared, they don't know if they're going to get cut. They have no idea, because VA has not communicated with these people. Because VA doesn't deem them necessary to be communicated with. Because what goes on behind closed doors, trust me when I tell you, we've heard it, we've got recordings of it. The things they say about the caregivers and the veterans involved in this program is horrific. I would not... If I didn't want to do this the rest of my, what's left of my life, I would absolutely play this on loop every day for everybody to listen to, the garbage that these people say.
Can you share a few examples of...
Well, just talking about how that one veteran, I won't even say where so that it doesn't come up. One veteran, they were convinced that it was fraud. VA employees swore up and down. And the backstory is that veteran and his wife had bought a very large, beautiful house for a song. It was kind of like an estate sale, and they got in for an absolute, just an insane deal. And the caregiver coordinators and the team lead and the program manager, they called it the McMansion, and they refused to talk to these people. They swore that those people didn't deserve to be in the program, that the veteran was committing fraud. Mind you, the veteran at 36 years old is now about 90% of the time either wheelchair or walker-bound. So this is kind of garbage. We've had caregiver or program leads threaten to call child services because they kicked someone off the program. And the wife called up crying, hysterical, not knowing what happened. All she got was this letter saying, you're done, you're out of it. And they wouldn't talk to her. And when she kept calling back, they said if she called back or if she appealed, they were going to call child services and take her kids away from her.
Wow.
And we validated that they had no basis for this communication of any form, none. They did it as a threat to make her shut up and go away. This is, and they've called caregivers trailer trash, that the veterans are leeches, that they are absolutely convinced that we are in this program to solely for a check. And I've heard senior people, the people you see on TV, talk about the caregivers as if they're stupid, that they're uneducated on how to manage their finances, that they had to put in place, they wanted mandatory financial planning classes. They wanted mandatory that the caregiver had to have a separate bank account for this money so that the veteran couldn't touch it. They wanted mandatory training. Oh, get this. I almost forgot this. They started back over the summer doing illegal background checks on the caregivers. I'm talking criminal and credit background checks on the caregivers in preparation for these assessments, and I'm air quoting here. No consent, none. Didn't even know about it. They got the wrong one there. They got one check. who happens to also work for the her state's ADA's office. She got them right real quick. But we've gotten more and more of these where they're pulling this information without any consent, without even discussing it, and they have no legal need for it. It's a huge violation. And there's no one that's going to stop them because this goes all the way to the very top. So when they instituted these rules, and we did confirm with someone at VA central office that they're supposed to only do assessments on the new people coming into the program, which they haven't communicated with the community at all. So they're getting word out, but it's word of mouth through social media and stuff, but not through any targeted effort by VA. But they've already been doing these assessments on the legacy participants. We've Wow. been running informal polls asking the question. But VA will not do anything. And they still do not have a national director for the program. The last one who engineered and ran this entire disaster, she retired. And now she has been appointed by Joe Biden to be the team lead to run her VA run his VA transition team. And it's Margaret Cabot. So,
now, Lauren, let me ask you, I appreciate all that background. Let me ask you, with all that's going wrong with this program, and it sounds like the VA bureaucracy is just running amok, do you have much hope for, and I know we're going to get into the lawsuit here in a moment, but do you see much hope in the congressional committees on the House and the Senate side diving into this at some point?
I'm holding my breath. My organization, we're withholding comment on what, if anything, Congress will do or be able to do, because right now, all of Congress is in upheaval. The entire administration is in upheaval. We don't know for sure who's going to be sitting where after January 20th. We don't pick sides on any of this. We're nonpartisan about it. We're preparing other things to happen, whomever may be sitting at the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, or the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, but we have to wait till they're there before we can start communicating with them about it. We know who won their seats, and we're communicating with their offices to keep them abreast of what's going on now, which is the most recent thing is a week ago, our organization, again with NVLSB, which is National Veterans Legal Service Program, and they are rock stars, by the way.
Right, I agree with
you. Yeah, they asked us to join forces with them on this, and Sidley Austin basically did the ghostwriting on it, but they're listed as the attorneys. There is one named plaintiff besides us. We're listed as an associated plaintiff, and we are not seeking damages. I want to make that really, really clear. We are not seeking any type of monetary damages, and NVLSB and Sidley Austin are doing this pro bono. We're not asking for anything. We are simply looking for specific performance. The other named plaintiff, which is the Sheets family, what they're doing, because despite the fact that we're both plaintiffs in this, we are not communicating about who's going to do what. Whether or not they're going to seek remuneration, that's between them and the attorneys.
I see.
We want the specific performance. We want the court to look at the legality of, we would love to have handed them all of the rules and say, here, you know, we think this entire thing is, you know, birdcage liner. However, the court is never going to accommodate us for that. So we had to pick the things that were going to impact the most people. And the things that would impact the most people are the stipend change, the change to demanding or requiring a certain percentage eligibility. VA wants a 70% eligibility rating before they'll even talk to you about an application. And some other issues like state of residence. We had several cases before the Mission Act went into effect and the new rules came out of cases of snowbirds that had, you know, moving from or coming for the winter from, you know, northern states to Florida or Texas or what have you, and being told they had to reapply. And it's a national agency running a national program and that is not the case. It's never been the case. But that's been a common thread for the entire time the program's existed, is that if you move, you move from Texas to West Virginia, they make you reapply. And that's not what's supposed to happen. Now they're trying to codify it by putting it into these rules, by saying that you have to be a resident of the state. Well, that's all well and good, but we also have four territories that would automatically exclude, and we know for a fact that we have caregivers in the Philippines and Samoa and Puerto Rico. So those caregivers that are there would automatically be excluded under these new rules. We're in this because of the amount of manpower, and I mean, we are in the thousands now into this in manpower hours of handling cases, everything from initial applications to, because I don't know anything about the program, and you know, the VA, all you get is what's on their website. They won't even talk to you on the phone. They're very, very secretive, is almost the word to use, about what the eligibility is, and to discuss it with the caregiver and the veteran. They don't do it. They're like, here's a brochure, here's our website, go look at it. So people ask questions, to appeals, to questions about, I'm in the program, how's this new thing going to affect me? We've spent thousands of man hours doing this. And we are associated to this case because their continued denial to accept the law as it stands, to operate under the law as it stands, and to not try to rewrite the law without the benefit of Congress, is costing us man hours. And let me be really clear about this. This question came up the other day. We are a regular, normal, for-profit corporation. That does not mean we make any money. That doesn't mean we're out to make money. We function fully as a not-for-profit. We actually function as a non-profit. We don't make any money. We don't do fundraising. As you know, David and Rick, we've been known each other for years, and we don't do fundraising. We're not passing the hat. We have stuff for sale. Every dime that goes in literally goes out for an expense for the organization. The board of directors consists of five people, and we internally fund and pay for Veteran Warriors' existence for 11 years. We're not going to get dime one out of this. But what we don't want to do is spend the next 5 years trying to unjack this program again or still or continuously because VA just refuses to abide by the law. They truly believe now that they are omnipotent and that they are above the law, and we've seen evidence in other venues of this, in privacy violations and things like this, where VA is just, they believe they're autonomous now. And until we sue them, because the only thing that's ever been successful is taking VA to court. Asking them nicely to do their job has never been successful for anyone. So we are now in court.
I see. Any projection from your team of lawyers on how long this litigation might run on?
Now to forever. There's
okay.
Unfortunately, the first thing we're waiting for is for VA to file a motion to dismiss it for jurisdiction, because we did not file in the VA's court system. We filed in the Federal Circuit, because that is the appropriate venue to discuss any agency's rules and policies, and to have a decision made of whether or not these rules, because that's all it is, these are rules. These are not part of the law. So this is the proper venue. But they're going to try. That's going to be their first knee-jerk reaction. That hasn't come yet, but I'm sure any day now it will. And then we just go from there. We all can pretty much predict what their reactions are going to be to things. I'm hedging a guess of we might have some traction by summer. Maybe.
Let me ask you from a practical point of view, from our listeners who may be disabled veterans, their families, their caregivers, and I know you've mentioned, you know, the VA is rather secretive. They have a little information on their website, and when you really ask them questions, it seems like a very secretive, opaque process. What should our listeners know if they're already, let's say, applied for that program and they're waiting for a decision, any general, and I know this is always kind of dangerous to do a little information here, but any general.
I was going
to
say, how many attorneys do you know want to say that? I'm not an attorney.
I know. But any general insight you'd like to offer for our listeners?
Yeah, there's a few big hitter things I'm going to give up up front. First off, if the veteran served during Vietnam or after 9/11, right now those are the two periods are open according to the law. First and foremost, please don't scream at us or my staff or other caregivers. Unless that caregiver is the secretary of the VA or is a member of Congress, we didn't have any hand in how this came down. We're not the ones at fault. And we're working really hard. And people are donating thousands of hours of time and effort to do this. We are trying to fix this for everyone. But if you are one of those two eras and you haven't applied yet, and you believe, number one, you have a serious injury that requires assistance at least 10 hours a week by a caregiver, and right now, let's just say for the sake of argument and the discussion, that it's a family member. There's other qualities involved, but let's just say it's a family member, you need assistance, or they provide assistance. I will say there's two other pieces that most people do not understand. Number one, you have to be getting at least some of your care from the VA. And the requirement is you have to have a primary care team, whether it's a, doesn't necessarily have to be a primary care provider, but you have to have a doctor at VA that you see at least once a year. It could be a psychiatrist. We have one veteran that he doesn't have a PCM. He only has a pulmonologist at VA. He sees him every month, so he's good. You have to have that, and you have to have a treatment plan for whatever is wrong with you or be at such a stable point that there is no more treatment available for you, and the treatment plan is documented that you're as stable as you'll ever be. This is it, and you're just going to live. That has to be documented, because if that is the treatment plan, that there is no plan for you because there's nothing left to do for you, then that they can't disqualify you for that. If there is a treatment plan and you're not compliant with it, I am not opining on whether or not I agree with them giving you antipsychotics if you have PTSD, or that they tell you have to lose weight because you have a ischemic heart disease. Whatever their treatment plan says, if any time you refuse to do anything that's in that treatment plan and they document that, you are non-compliant. That is an automatic disqualifier.
Wow.
So those are the four big hitter things up front.
Okay. And what can they expect from what your team's been able to hear from people and just your own assessment? What can they then expect? So they get online and they initiate this whole process by answering a few questions on the website, and then any insights that you'd like to offer to them that maybe to try to maneuver through this minefield that they're going to encounter?
Well, first and foremost, this is as painful as going through the claims process. Probably a little more so, because you actually can talk to these people, just a lot of times they choose not to. Claims examiners, you don't get to talk to ever. The first thing to expect is once your application is formally submitted, track everything. Get a notebook. Just track it all. Track everything that happens, every phone call, every...
Hey, Lauren, we have a caller.
Yes.
If we'd like to take that. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour. You have a question for our guest?
I do. I've been sitting here listening to her speak very eloquently, by the way. I come from a 8-star family, a lot of military vets in my family. My dad was a VA, struggled with a lot of VA issues at the hospital, so I'm starting to hear things that are bringing back memories from like 30 years ago. But I have a question for Lauren is this. I'm listening to her, and I've been actually following her in her efforts the last 11 years and what she's been doing as an advocate for the vets. But I only see vets trying to help themselves. I see her trying to help the vets. I travel around the country. I have a global organization that does charity work, and we run a lot of vets at group organizations. What can we do as the public? I mean, I'm not a vet, but I try to help when I can, when I'm around them, or when I go down to D.C. for an event, or I'm on the bike across the country somewhere, and I run into a group, and you know, we try to supply materials and things. What should we be doing rather than put this all on Lauren and your organization and the other organizations and the lawyers that are trying to help you? What should the public be doing?
Great question.
Thank you very much for asking that. The question, the answer is the same one I've given to everybody. Talk to your members of Congress. Mm-hmm. Find out if your members sitting on any of the committees that affect veterans' benefits, the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, or even the Armed Forces Committees, because all of that is a flow-through, and trust on each other, they all talk to each other. But demand that they hold the VA financially accountable. Do you know that no one's ever audited the VA? This program, this one little program, right now there are less than 20,000 people in this program, and the budget that they are currently working under for this one little program, $900 million. And we've proven that last year they had that much money and they only spent half of it. We can't find where the rest of it went. And no one demands, when there's been demands for accountability, and the current administration has put together legislation that says, you know, we're going to remove the bad actors, we're going to restrict their ability to stay on ad infinitum for, you know, 5 years of appeal, getting paid to sit at home. Encourage your legislators to step into this, even if they're not a veteran, because the first thing they say, well, you know, I'm not a veteran, I'm not on the committee. They talk to each other all day long. They reach out to each other, and their staffers, their professional staff, their chief of staff, their legislative directors, make friends with those people. Those are the ones that really do the work. Those are the ones that will tell your legislator what is important and what really is important with the VA, whether it's, which doesn't matter which side of the house it is that we have to have full transparency. We have to know where every penny is going, because it has the second largest budget in the federal government, and yet not one dime is accounted for. They tell us, you know, how much they spent on stuff, but we've never audited anything, and yet every year we're told they need more money to do this, they need more money to stop suicides, they need more money to run this program, they need more money to provide health care for veterans, and yet in the next breath they get more money, and then 2 years later we're back to, oh, well, we're sorry, we're backlogged again. We're backlogged, why? Oh, well, because we need more money. It's not about money. It's about there's no accountability, there's bad behavior, there's bad actors. There's so many bad actors. And we can't get rid of them. They're unionized. We have people that have been convicted of vehicular manslaughter. One was convicted of armed robbery, went and did her 2 years in prison and came back right back into her job. These are the people that work for VA. We need the strength to get them out, and only Congress can make that happen. And the average American, you have the almighty vote, and you guys can work with your legislators and hold them accountable to your demands. And the best demand is be a good steward with your tax dollars. The veterans, did you know that less than one-third of a veteran population actually uses VA healthcare? That's the most embarrassing thing of this whole thing. Less than one-third, roughly around 7 million veterans use VA healthcare. And we have roughly around 22 million veterans in the nation right now. So if they should not need this extensive amount of money to run it properly, and then we should not still be having a scandal a week that shows up of horrible things happening to veterans.
That sounds like just another whole show hour of talking and asking why veterans don't go. And I know my dad stopped going because of the frustration, and the almost half a dozen times they almost killed him by diagnosing him incorrectly. But, you know, that's just another story I'd love to hear in another show about why they don't go in and get the help they need and why they stay away.
Yeah, it's there are many of us that do not utilize VA healthcare because it's so bad, and it's somewhere between the medical incompetence and the civility incompetence. You go in there and you're treated like you're there on sufferance, and I've seen people, employees at VA, scream in a World War II veteran's face and tell them to get to the back of the line. And I was shocked that I did not end up in jail that day. But all he was asking for was a form, a piece of paper, and she screamed in his face to get to the back of the line and wait his turn. And this stuff happens all the time. We can do a show about that every single day, but the biggest thing I will tell people is, despite the turmoil that's going on right now, the best thing you could ever do is hold your legislators accountable for your demands, for what you want of your tax dollars. And if you want your VA to be literally not their figurehead made-up label of world-class, because we just call it third world-class, if you want it to be that, if you want our VA in this nation to be the shining star of the world, of where everybody wants to come to get care, then we need to force Congress to make that happen. Because VA is apparent, they will never do it on their own. They will never do it under their own steam.
Well, I think that sums it up well. And sir, thank you so much for calling in and your interest and for listening in on our show. We've just got about 4 minutes left in our show. And before we wrap things up, let me just ask Rick Hurley. Rick, any questions for Lauren?
No, I know we're getting to the end of the evening. This is why, Lauren, you can come back on our show anytime you want, because as our caller just indicated, we have so many topics that we could discuss. I could share my own concerns and problems and frustrations when I deal with the VA on a daily basis trying to represent veterans on these compensation claims. So please come back whenever you can. Yeah. You're doing great work.
Oh, thank you, gentlemen. I do appreciate it. Real quick, our website is veteran-warriors.org. There's a contact button on there, and we don't just handle the caregiver program. That's actually just one section of ours. Please feel free to reach out to us if there's anything VA-related that we can assist with.
Well, we certainly will. And Lauren, thanks so much for joining us again, and I hope you'll be back to keep us updated on not only the caregiver program, but also I know the open-air burn pit issue is still a big ongoing issue for the Iraq and Afghanistan war vets. So thanks so much, Lauren, for being with us.
Well, thanks again, gentlemen. Talk to you very soon.
Yep, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, we're wrapping things up in just about 2 minutes. So, Rick, why don't you bring our weekly Coaching into Care reminder.
I sure will. And again, I want to really thank Lauren for being on our show tonight. She was terrific. She always is. She's very enlightening as to what's going on with the VA. Our Coaching into Care program, you know, this is a program that helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home and returning to a civilized lifestyle can be a tough adjustment. And the loved ones of veterans can help. Coaching into Care offers free coaching to help family members help their veteran. Give the program a call. It's 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, the VA's Coaching into Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I would like to once again remind our listeners, if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in distress or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs has the Veterans Crisis Line to help. That number is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, that Veterans Crisis Line number is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Well, we'd like to thank all of you for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. We'd like to thank our producer, Mr. Doug Newsom, and we hope you'll tune in next week, 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 Central, 5 Mountain, and 4 p.m. Pacific Time here on BBSRadio.com Station 1. Until then, have a great week. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on VBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.